I'm going to take a little bit of a punt that my next guest is able to get through. She'll be ringing from Fiji. We're going to talk about a book that she's written. She's a journalist and an author. She's written a book called The Town of Love. I thought this rather appropriate. I dreamed a dream. It's from Les Mis with Deborah Byrne.
There was a time when men were kind, when their voices were soft and their words inviting. There was a time when love was blind and the world was a song and the song was exciting. There was a time, then it all went wrong. I dreamed a dream in time gone by, when hope was high and life worth living. I dreamed that love would never die. I dreamed that God would be forgiven. Then I was young and unafraid, and dreams were made and used and wasted. There was no ransom to be paid, no song unsung, no wine untasted. But the time tigers come at night with their voices soft as thunder as they tear your home apart, as they turn your dream to my side. He filled my days with endless wonder. He took my childhood in his stride, but he was gone when autumn came. And still I dream he'll come to me, that we will live the years together. But there are dreams that cannot be, and there are storms we cannot weather. I had a dream my life would be so different from this hell.
You're listening to 96.5 NRFM Morning Magazine with Marie. And with that beautiful, beautiful number, I Dreamed a Dream, I'd like to very, very warmly welcome a very special lady, Anne-Christine Ostby. She is a Norwegian journalist. She's also an author of 9 books. Her stories frequently depict women's lives and struggles in various cultures around the world. when she wrote Town of Love, which has just been published in Australia, in Norway in 2012. It was supported by Focus, which is the Norwegian Resource Centre for International Women's Issues, which partners with the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women. Since 1990, Anne Østby has lived in Denmark, Malaysia, Pakistan, Kazakhstan and the United States and Iran, currently in Fiji, but she's going back to Norway. She has found the book that she's written. The journey behind this story has been long, eventful, and has spanned several continents. It's been one of pain, distress, and exasperation, but also one of love, hope, an unimaginable strength. Good morning and welcome, Anne, and congratulations on a marvellous book. It was riveting. Hello, Anne.
Thank you so much for having me.
Are you having difficulty getting through? You know, you're ringing from Fiji, so this is a bit of an experiment. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the book, please.
Yes, I would love to. Thank you, Marie. The book was actually sparked by a meeting I had with an anti-trafficking activist from India, Ruchira Gupta, who was running an NGO there to help women out of prostitution. And she invited me to come and see her work. And in the beginning, I didn't really think that this would be a book, but it developed, and I met the women there. And when I'd heard some other stories, I realized two things: that I couldn't just, you know, get up, turn my back on them, and walk away. And number two, I wanted to write their story. So the journey took from the very, very beginning, about 5 years, until publication in Norway last year and in the English language this year.
My goodness, that's a very, very long journey. And it was your sister who translated into the English language.
It was my oldest daughter.
Oh, yeah. It's your daughter. Oh, there you go. Now, why did I think it was a sister? Oh, there you are. Well, that's brilliant.
Marisa, I don't know.
she did a brilliant translation anyway, because the book is quite riveting. And now, tell us about it. It's a book of a very sad story in many ways, but it's also a story of hope. It's a story of courage. It's a story of, you know, how much difference education can make. Could you tell us a bit about it, please?
Absolutely. The story takes place in a red light district on the outskirts of a sort of medium-sized town in the northern Indian state of Bihar, where the knot caste has for centuries been living off prostituting their women. In the older days, they were like traveling, more like what you maybe would call gypsies, you know, doing dancing, handiwork, odd jobs like that, but also known for prostituting their women. Now, for several hundred years now, maybe 100, 150 years now, they have been stationary, not traveling so much anymore. But what is lasting as their livelihood is the men prostituting their women. And this is happening within the sort of family surroundings. It's in the houses, in their own homes. So it would be like the male patriarch, of the house might prostitute his wife, his daughter, his daughter-in-law, so that they will also contribute to the family income this way. So the men mostly don't work, and the women, the girls, they are being sort of reared into this, fostered into this from their very small. They see what their mothers and their older sisters are doing, and they know it's been instilled in them that this is your responsibility. From when you come of age, normally around the time they reach puberty, it'll be your responsibility to feed the family. It'll be your responsibility that we have food. So this is something that is like a tradition. It's a culture, but I do not want to defend it as, you know, it's a cultural thing that we cannot react against. I do think that this is something that it is changing, and I have been helped a lot in my research from the organization that my friend in Tehran is running, because without the logistics, without their help with interpretation, without the help of you know, getting me in touch with them at all, I would never have been able to do this.
And
so I trust. Sorry. Yeah.
Yep. Sorry. You wrote it. It's actually a novel, but it is a true novel.
It is a novel, and I chose the novel as a genre because well, because that's, you know, that's what I do, write novels, but also because I think that there's a lot of people who could write better documentaries than me. And also I'm thinking, we have read many documentaries, we have read grueling stories of women selling their bodies, so what is it that makes this novel material? For me, it's actually because I am a mother of three daughters, and to me it was unfathomable, incomprehensible to think of, you know, you hold your newborn daughter in your arms and you know that this is going to be her fate. She is going to inherit your life. And that is what appealed to me, and that I thought that is the material of a novel. And also, of course, if you write a novel, you are more, you can more sharpen the angle, you can more, you don't have to bring in everything else which has to be there to make a true documentary picture, which would, you know, clutter, mm-hmm. in a sense, the novel topic that you want to focus on. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, goodness, yes. But now, into this whole genre, and this is what actually happened, there was the wonderful Salim and some of the other characters. Firstly, there was the school that started.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yes, the school exists, and the school is one of the really, you know, glimmering rays of hope in the town of Love. Because this organization that I was sort of piggybacking on all the way, it's called Apne Aap, meaning self-help in Hindi. And Apne Aap is in many ways the model for the organization that you meet in the book, which I have chosen to call Pukar. They do a lot of work in the town of Love and in other red light areas. And they have set up this school, which, although it is unrecognized by the authorities, it doesn't give them any formal certificate or anything, at least it is a way to learn some basic reading and writing. It is a way to get out of the house for a few hours, if nothing else. And it is a way of starting the kids on a path to something bigger. The schoolhouse is very simple. The kids' attendance isn't 100%. Some come and some go. Some days the parents tell them, you can't go to school, I need you at home. But it's better than nothing. It's much better than nothing.
And it also, I think it also shows that with a bit of education, with getting the community together and getting them to rethink the way things have always been, you can bring about change. And of course, you do need people with a tremendous amount of courage to go against the tide.
That is true, because what these women are fighting against, it's not only the enormous amount of violence involved, the centuries of tradition that this is your faith, this is your karma, but it's also the day-to-day struggle of, you know, can I spend time on doing community work, you know, supporting the school, doing things for the organization, or could I just have to feed my family, because that is the stark reality. And for these children, I see that there's more and more, that there's more consciousness being brought into the whole community, because they see that the children can do things that they can't. Their children can read a pamphlet. Their children can fill in a form for them. This is something, like you're saying, this is small things bringing about tremendous change. And it is all about courage. These women are tremendously courageous.
Well, these women were beaten to within inches of their lives if they don't submit to what the husbands and the brothers and the males in the family want.
Yes, that is right. There's a tremendous amount of violence, as I said, and they have lived through a lot. But my hope is also that is changing, because it all has to do with raising the value of human dignity within the community. And these women are, they're some of the most courageous and, as I said, very dignified characters that you could imagine. Because that's one of the things that I really have learned during this long journey with this book, that dignity has really nothing to do with your surroundings or where you come from or the path that, you know, you think is there for you that you have to follow. It has to do with how you hold yourself and what you believe to be just and right. And that is what you know, brings about change in the long run, I think.
You're hoping, I think, that with the changes in the various, I'm assuming there are more towns like the Town of Love, all around that particular area. I gather you're hoping that the mindset will change, particularly if the people are given some other way of making a living.
Yes, you're right, and that's what it's all about, actually. Because, you know, these are tough women. They are not crybabies. They don't complain. I had many, many hours of talks and discussions with them. You know, what are your alternatives? And of course, you're absolutely right. This is what it's all about. Give us, and they would say to me in plain language, give us a job, give us something to do that will provide us with the same amount of rupees every day, and we would gladly change. But before you can show us what that is, this is what we have to do, because we have to feed our children.
You also had a very, very courageous young man who became a lawyer thanks to the work his sister did. And he makes a difference. In the end, he takes a stand and he starts talking, getting the men there and talking to them and trying to get them to change their philosophy.
Yes. And I think that it is a very blatant fact that unless the men are on board, it's very difficult to bring real change about, because the gender structure is such that the women are still the ones that are being told what to do, and unless the men are totally understanding why change has to come about, for example, through the children's education, as we talked about. Unless they understand, it is going to be maybe not impossible, but much, much slower to make a change. And Salim, the character that you are referring to, he is actually based, not entirely, but to a large degree, on a real person, a very, very courageous young man who's been arrested, who's been beaten, who has been betrayed by his own people, all for doing what he does. He stands up for the other side, for the people who come into the community and say, we want your women to stop doing what they're doing, which is, you know, to him, a right thing to do. But then, of course, he is, by supporting that, he is also going against all that his clan has always taught him is right, or what his family stands for, all the loyalties that come to a conflict in his character. That is why I made him so central in the story.
You made him very real, because he did have doubts and he was afraid. Suddenly he looked at this and he's sort of saying to himself, well, you know, the whole family's doing this. You know, to actually then turn around and take an active role in opposing them took an incredible amount of courage.
It did, and he has done that. He has done exactly that. There are people in his family, in his village, who are not in favor of what he's doing, and he has been attacked. But he has stood his ground. He's really been a pillar, and I admire him very much.
Now, on another note, right up to today, there are young girls being kidnapped, because in this particular village, it isn't just the girls that are born there that are used as a means of supporting the men. They also actually kidnap or accept young girls who are kidnapped and nurture them, or not nurture them exactly, but support them until they're ready to bring in an income. Now, what's happening about that trade? Now, you couldn't have a trade like that without the police turning a blind eye to it all.
Yes, yes, and that is part of the problem, of course. You're referring to the story of Nina, who is a woman that I've actually dedicated the book to. She was kidnapped as a little girl, and she was put into a brothel of the kind where, you know, when you and I think the word brothel, we probably think of a house with, you know, lots of girls and men coming in and out, and that is the kind of brothel that she was brought into and kept for many years. The brothel that we were talking about a few minutes ago is what's happening in the homes in the Town of Love. Now, there are two different kind of brothels, but this kidnapped girl that I know of particularly, she was brought into what we might think of as more like traditional brothel, with a brothel madam and a brothel keeper and his wife, who kept her locked up. And the police are turning a blind eye is sadly reality in very many places, at least. She was telling me how a lot of times, how she, from she was a little girl, she managed to get herself to the police station, crying for her mother, wanting to be sent something. I don't belong in this house. They've taken me there. And, they were just sending her back. Even as a grown woman coming with the same story, trying to get her daughter out of the same brothel, she's not listened to. And the reason is, of course, that the police is getting something in return. You know, by keeping this trade going, by turning a blind eye, maybe taking some money, taking, having access to the girls. And this is one of the things that the organization that I talked about is working with. They run, like, sensitivity training for the police force. They run courses for them. They cooperate with some of the police stations on the border to stop the traffic of girls coming across from Nepal, which is a very open border. So they are working with that side also.
It's quite, it was an incredible eye-opener for me. I certainly would recommend it to everyone to read and, you know, think about what we can do as women to stop that sort of a trade. It is one thing when an adult willingly goes into that sort of a profession, but it is a different thing when young children have no choice. They're kidnapped and bought and sold like goods. And used this way.
That's right. I think that's what we can do on a local level wherever we are is spreading awareness. I was just reading some statistics yesterday that 2 million women worldwide are trafficked every year. It's a global thing we're talking about here. It's happening in the Pacific. Girls are being trafficked where I come from in Europe. It's happening everywhere. And I think it has to do with not accepting that human beings can be bought and sold. We cannot accept that in no shape or form.
Isn't it amazing? Because we thought slavery had finished, but it really hasn't.
It hasn't. This is slavery. This is slavery of the worst kind.
Mm. And look, can I congratulate you for a magnificent book, a very thought-provoking book, a beautifully written book. And as I said, I found it quite riveting. It's not something that I would have gone out of my way to buy, but I found it, or even to read. But having sort of made the commitment, I actually found it impossible to put down. It resonated. And, you know, surely we need to be aware of these things and see what we can do to stop them.
That is right. That's right. Thank you for your support. I'm glad you like the book.
Oh, terrific. So it's The Town of Love by Anne Ostby and Christine Ostby. Congratulations and many, many thanks. I'm absolutely amazed that you were able to get through from Fiji, and I'm very, very grateful.